This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This morning, President Obama announced that his administration will offer GM and Chrysler a little more time to negotiate with creditors and restructure. He blamed a failure of leadership from Washington and Detroit that led our auto companies to this point and admitted there will be more bad news. Some jobs will be lost. Some plants, he said, will not reopen. Despite what he called a good faith effort, he rejected GM's restructuring plan as not strong enough and said he will provide operating funds to give the company another 60 days.
After broad consultation with a range of industry experts and financial advisors, I'm absolutely confident that GM can rise again, providing that it undergoes a fundamental restructuring.
Chrysler got 30 days to work out a merger with Italian manufacturer Fiat, with the promise of $6 billion if it can and the prospect of bankruptcy if it can't. And about an hour after the president concluded, Chrysler released a statement saying it had reached an agreement with Fiat on a global alliance. Will this new plan work? What happens if it fails? We want to hear from those of you who work in the auto industry in particular. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, it's the Talk of the Nation opinion page, and columnist Leonard Pitt joins us to talk about the state of Black America and its implications. But joining us now from the studios of WUOM, our member station in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Michelle Maynard, the senior business correspondent for The New York Times. Nice to have you on the program again.
Thank you very much.
And let's begin with Chrysler, if we will. A global alliance, that's not quite the same as a merger.
Well, it's actually a little bit of a false alarm because Chrysler did put out a press release saying that and then kind of let everybody know, whoops, we're a little ahead of ourselves. So they're talking about a global alliance, but they haven't concluded one yet.
Micheline, as you look at this agreement with Chrysler, 30 days is not a very long time to these are two giant corporations.
Well, they've been talking already, and they've kind of sketched out what it would look like. And actually, Fiat's not putting up any money. This would get Fiat back into the American market after being gone for well over 10 years. And for Chrysler, it offers the opportunity that they might be able to use the underpinnings of Fiat cars as they develop the kind of small vehicles that President Obama wants to see.
But their alliance with Mercedes-Benz did not work out so well. Why do we think Fiat will work out any better?
Well, I think there's a little bit more of a need here. The Daimler-Chrysler merger from 1998 to last year was really a sort of a separate arrangement. They left Chrysler on its own, left Mercedes on its own, and they never really shared very much. In this instance, Fiat gets back into the American market in quite an easy way, and Chrysler gets a little bit of a white knight at a time when it needs it most. So I think they need each other more, perhaps, than Mercedes and Chrysler did in the 1990s.
The president said today that the federal government has no interest in running General Motors, no intention of running General Motors, yet he fired the president of General Motors and announced that from now on the federal government's going to back up their warranty.
That's right. And actually, a lot of us think that there'll be a player to be named later in the form of someone called a chief restructuring officer. That might happen if they're forced to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, or it might even happen if they don't. If they end up getting the billions of dollars from the government that they want, there'll probably be someone who brings the bags of money to Detroit, and that would be this person.
And but there's implicit in the president's statements today. Look, I need to see something in 60 days or else.
You know, there was a little bit of a game of chicken going on, Neil. One of the restructuring plans were announced in December. There's sort of whispers that, oh, the March 31st deadline doesn't mean anything and we can get the loan terms loosened up and, you know, we'll get more time. Well, I think they were caught off guard by what happened with Rick Wagner, the CEO of General Motors, resigning and the president issuing some very stern warnings to them in front of the whole world to basically get their act together in a couple of months.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Dan Neal, the automotive critic for the Los Angeles Times, with us now from the paper's newsroom in Los Angeles. And Dan, nice to have you back on the program, too.
Thank you, Neil. Nice to be here.
So which part of the president's remarks should we be paying attention to? We will turn, bear any burden to make sure the car industry goes on into the 21st century, or you guys better watch out?
I think it's the 60 days part that we should pay attention to. Really, I'm having trouble imagining how General Motors restructures sufficiently to satisfy the requirements. The bondholders are not willing to back down. I think the unions have conceded all they are going to concede. And more than that, you know, in an environment where there are only 9 or 10 million cars being bought in the U.S. market annually, this company still is vastly oversized for its ecosystem. And they can't find anybody to buy things like Hummer and Saab. They're still going to be facing a dramatic liquidity problem 60 days hence.
Yet the president said more sacrifices are going to be required. Some jobs will be lost. Plants will not reopen. Clearly, whatever 60 days from now, this is going to be a different company than anything we've ever been familiar with our whole lives.
That is true. And I also think that we're going to have to live through a bankruptcy or a bankruptcy-like proceeding. You know, Wagner really owned this idea that GM simply couldn't go into Chapter 11 because it would scare off all the buyers. Well, what happened was the bad news and the crisis scared off buyers anyway. And so you have these measures that like the government guaranteeing warranty work, which is really, when you step back, that's an extraordinary step. And as you noted, it's extraordinary for the president to basically fire the CEO of a major company. I believe and I advocated a version of nationalizing GM in November, and I believe that we have crossed those thresholds into nationalization in all but name.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's see if we can go to Bob. Bob's with us from Granville in Michigan.
Good afternoon, Neil. Love your show. Thank you.
Thank you.
I work in the supplier business. Have worked in the supplier business for many years. And there's a huge number of suppliers, of course, that are dependent upon this. It's not just, you know, the big OEM. And what's interesting is I was a big supporter for Mr. Obama, and right now I feel like he's come out and he's laid this heavy hand on the automobile industry, but he isn't telling them, okay, here's the target. That's what we're used to in this industry. Here's what you got to meet. What plan does the automobile industry have to meet? Don't say bring us a plan. Say, okay, what do we got to meet? What do we got to do in order to survive? Don't say bring us a plan or you might go bankrupt. I'd like Mr. Obama to step up and say, here's what you have to do, or else you're, you know, we're not going to help you.
We're going to pull.
I think we need to be a little more definitive so we know what the target is we're shooting for.
Mickey Maynard, is there a specific plan like that?
There are some specifics, and if you go on nytimes.com, we have the files listed of what the president handed down last night. I'm sure they're on the LA Times website and at NPR as well. And I think there are a couple of things. First of all, they want the bondholders to give concessions. They want the UAW to give concessions. They essentially want more proof that the automakers are going to develop fuel-efficient vehicles going forward. I mean, they're not in the business of writing business plans, and I think that does frustrate a lot of people who want Obama to say, do this, that, this, and that. But I think what they want to see from the car companies is that they are reading the administration correctly and will come back with something that will reassure them.
Bob, we also...
Again, that's pretty vague. To me, if I'm a CEO, concessions, we've done concessions here, we've done concessions there. You know, how do you know when you reach the goal line if all we say is, here's some things we want, but we don't know what we have to reach? And I know this is all a big negotiation, but nevertheless, I think the automobile company needs to know what concessions do we have to reach this target and reach this goal.
Bob, let me also ask, we just read recently of some of that money going to help parts suppliers to the big auto manufacturers. Is that money coming through? Are you seeing any of it? Bob?
The suppliers, I wouldn't be able to answer that. I think you better talk to somebody from like JCI or Lear or some of those kinds of companies that are, you know, deeply engaged in this in terms of, you know, multi-billion-dollar, you know, businesses, and I really can't answer that.
All right. In other words, you haven't seen any.
No, I haven't. I'm laid off. because of the slowdown in the automobile industry. Mm-hmm. So I can say, but I'm not one of the chosen few. I just started a new business to support the automobile industry again. So I'm kind of the odd man out here. I'm doing it the opposite way. I'm going back to try to support them again.
Nice to hear from an optimist, Bob. Thanks very much. Good luck to you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Fred. And Fred's from Farmington Hills. Farmington Heights in Michigan. A lot of calls from Michigan today, I suspect.
Yeah, we are suffering. You know, we're in a single-state depression here. I'm a photographer. I'm a Tier 2 supplier. I service a couple of the autos. But my fear is that, you know, all these plants are closing. All the mom-and-pop businesses around these plants are just dying, just dying. And then the president takes and removes Rick Wagner, and the union really has dug their heels in. Why didn't he remove Ron Gettelfinger?
Any ideas as to that relationship, Dan Neal?
No, I don't. I know that, well, I take that back. Look, Obama got elected by winning the Midwest. He absolutely has to secure the goodwill of labor in the Midwest, and that, I think, has probably made him more patient with these restructuring plans than perhaps he would be otherwise.
He's playing political favors with millions of people's of jobs, and that's wrong.
Well, no, he's trying to keep people in their jobs as long as possible, and it might be political, but I think it probably serves a good purpose in the case of an economic downturn where we could be looking at double-digit unemployment in the U.S. That is not necessarily a bad impulse to follow if you're a president and your Democratic Congress is up for election in a year and a half.
Fred, thanks for the call, and we wish you luck, too.
Thank you.
We're talking with Mickey Maynard of the New York Times, a senior business correspondent, and with Dan Neal, the automotive critic of the Los Angeles Times, and with you. Is this plan announced earlier today by the president to give General Motors and Chrysler a bit more time going to work? What happens if it fails? Stay with us. I'm Neal Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neal Conan in Washington. Earlier today, President Obama rejected restructuring plans offered by General Motors and Chrysler. He expressed confidence in those companies' ability to succeed with major restructuring. He gave them 60 and 30 days, respectively, promised operating funds for that remaining period of time, but said the taxpayer would not be beholden unless they go about major changes. We're talking about what that restructure may look like and what might happen if it doesn't push the ailing companies into real viability. Our guests, New York Times senior business correspondent Micheline Maynard and LA Times auto critic Dan Neal. We want to hear from you. Can the plan work? What happens if it fails? Email us, talk@npr.org. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. And let's go to Don, and Don's calling from Detroit.
Yeah, I'm the biggest supporter of Obama in the country. I mean, I'm just as big as anybody else. But what I think he did today is he danced around the white elephant in the room, and that's pensioners' benefits, from pension to health care. I mean, we don't want the pensioners, probably 700,000 of them, to lose their pensions, go down to 60% of what they were supposed to take with the government-guaranteed pension trust. We don't want them to lose their health care and become a burden on society. They're already covered with health care. As far as being on par with the southern car manufacturers, we're right there. I mean, our new employees start at $14 an hour. They have no guaranteed pension. They have a 401. I think we're within $2 or $3 of what they make.
Well, I'm hearing two parts in there, Don, one of which is you're saying we've already made all the concessions we're going to make?
Well, I'm sure there's going to be more concessions made, but how much do they want? I mean, the white elephant in the room is the pensioners. Do they want them to just drop the is that the point of bankruptcy, just drop the people who are on pensions and let the government take care of get their 60%?
Mickey Maynard, is that what's in the cards?
There is a lot of talk about that, and actually, to clarify a couple of things, the pensions and healthcare are a little bit separate from each other. if the pensions are put on the back of the federal government in the form of the PBGC, it would be more like 33% to 34% of what people are promised in their pensions. And the PBGC, the guarantee fund, has essentially said, you know, we'll go under if we're forced to take over the pensions for General Motors and Chrysler. So that's a real concern, and that's going to have to be sorted out. As far as health care is concerned, there are a lot of people on the General Motors health care plan, for example, who never worked for General Motors. They have covered surviving spouses and surviving spouses of retirees. And the healthcare plan for active workers has changed quite a bit, but it's that healthcare plan for retirees that has been the largest burden, and that has been something that has not been touched as much as it could be in all of this discussion.
And Dan, Neil, let me ask you, there's also, this is all, and Don, thanks very much for the call. This is all in the context, the political context of a country where more money is unpopular with the American people, according to opinion polls, and unpopular with Congress.
That's right. And I'm often astonished at the schadenfreude that surrounds this conversation. People have say, you know, let him go under, let him go bankrupt. You know, it's the natural order of capitalism. And it would be hard to imagine what that would mean in the current economic environment. It would mean a real – I think it would push us into depression. And so – it's not popular to spend this money. In many ways, a lot of people see this as the battle's already over and these companies are toast. But it's – I don't blame the administration for their forbearance on this. There are some big problems, though. Retiree health care is a huge burden to these companies. They've gotten rid of the job bank. So there's the unions have made significant concessions. They have also been scapegoated in the larger political argument, which is too bad. But where is this money going to come from in the future? How are these companies going to survive to fight a new day? I don't see it unless there's a significant bridge apparatus built by the government.
Mickey Maynard, do you have an idea of what General Motors might look like if it got a plan approved 60 days from now? How many divisions, for example, might it have?
Well, GM has said most recently in the last month or so that they plan to get rid of Saturn by 2012. They're trying to find a buyer for Saab. They're getting rid of Hummer. They're shrinking Pontiac to something that's called a focused niche brand. So they're saying that they'll have about four major divisions. There are people that are arguing they could get by with two, Chevrolet and Cadillac. The other thing that they've said is that they're going to cut another 47,000 jobs. And, you know, I've watched General Motors shrink down, and it gets smaller and smaller, and it still isn't making any money, and it still isn't a successful company. And I don't think just eliminating jobs at this point is what's going to save General Motors.
And we're still, what, a year and a half away from the introduction of the electric battery vehicle, the Chevrolet Volt?
Right, and so much emphasis is being put on the Volt. And the Volt is a niche vehicle. You know, they're going to sell 10,000 in the first year. It's going to cost $40,000. This isn't something that's going to be an everyday car for you and me. It's going to be a third or fourth car for a lot of wealthy people.
And inevitably, Dan Neil can back this up. Any new car, the first 6 months, it's going to be a lot of glitches.
I'm not prepared to make that prediction about the Volt, but you want to see losing money. Wait until the Volt comes out, because the Volt is a money loser. And this is the problem. You know, there's a fundamental tension between what people say they want. They want these companies to reinvent themselves and make these, you know, high mileage, fuel efficient, next generation technology and all of that. And all of that is a money loser. There is no commercial case for that. I'm not saying we shouldn't build them. In fact, I'm saying we should build them as fast as we can, because they would serve a larger national strategic interest, namely oil, balance of trade, global warming. But to require these companies, on top of everything else they face, to revolutionize their product portfolio and expect them to bear the burden of those costs is unrealistic. And so really, that's another talk about an elephant in the room. That is a huge elephant.
Let's go to Jeffrey. Jeffrey with us from Tulsa.
Hey, Neil. Good to be with you. I kind of have this question. You know, you're talking about the oil industry there. How come nobody has say, suggested to General Motors, why don't you license Tesla Motor Company to produce their cars, give them their production facilities to use and create more and more of their vehicles? I mean, they've created a completely electric sports car for $150,000. If that came out of any European company, it'd be in the millions of dollars range. If they could have the production facilities of GM, wouldn't they be able to bring their cost way down so everybody could actually afford an electric car, cure our ozone issues, cure our environmental issues by getting off of oil and gasoline?
Daniel, are we going to see Panacea Motors?
Heck no. absolutely not. Mickey and I are both laughing because, you know.
Give everybody a Tesla.
Yeah, that's an awesome idea. Look, Tesla is a hole in California in which you pour money. They have built a sports car called the Tesla Roadster. It's $109,000, and it's an all-electric car. It has a very, very expensive and heavy and sort of last-generation technology battery. They just came out with the Model S, which is their sedan version of it, or sedan electric car. And they are asking for $450 million in Department of Energy grants to build a factory. Right? Again, there's no Tesla isn't making money. They're losing money. They're spending money. Again, I'm not saying that Tesla is a bad company. It's an honorable, wonderful thing, and we should all admire it. But GM knows more about car building than Tesla will ever know. And so it's not a question of expertise or facilities or a deep engineering bench or any of that, or vision for that matter. Larry Burns, the head of advanced powertrain for General Motors, is a genius. But it's the business case around all of that that is so untenable.
Mickey Maynard, and thank you very much, Jeffrey. If the inevitable happened, not the inevitable, if it went ahead and GM and Chrysler both declared bankruptcy, I mean, would you see the blossoming of little companies like Tesla, or would the American car market be taken over by the Japanese and other imports?
No, but I think a couple of things about bankruptcy. First of all, the sort of doomsday scenario about bankruptcy is if they liquidate. I covered the airline industry and went through 6 bankruptcy cases, and all those airlines are still with us. So I know there's the argument that nobody would buy a car from a bankrupt car company, but the government now is going to guarantee the warranties of General Motors and Chrysler vehicles. So somebody will buy a car from one of those companies if they file for bankruptcy. I think what will happen is we'll probably see one of them go away, and my bet is on Chrysler simply because it's the smaller company. I also think that we have to talk about Ford, because Ford did not get bailout money. Ford is trying to make it without government assistance. They seem to be keeping their act together. I'm a little worried about them and everybody in this unending auto slump. But we have Toyota here. We have Honda here. We have Mercedes and BMW and Nissan and Hyundai and Kia, and Volkswagen's going to build a plant in Tennessee. So we have, you know, more than half of auto sales in the United States are non-U.S. companies. We have an auto industry. It just isn't owned by Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Let's get Dean on the line. Dean in Boston.
You know, hi. I'm a former automobile dealer and presently do consulting work with a lot of the large dealer groups in the U.S. One of the things that I think the government's ignoring is we could talk about the inadequacies of Detroit all day long, but they've overlooked, I believe, the inadequacies of the dealer body in the United States, the point of contact with the customer. Some of the most outrageous, let's call them financial crimes committed in the United States are committed daily in automobile dealerships against their customers. And one of the reasons a large Chevrolet dealer group, Bill Hurd, was shut down last year was that the state of Georgia essentially had enough of them, and Chevrolet shut down 13 stores that sold almost 40,000 new Chevrolets a year. So I think the government's ignoring many important issues, which is how are dealers dealing with customers, and what can they do to make that a better experience for them.
Is Dean onto something here, Dan?
Well, I wouldn't. You know, the import dealers are no better than the domestic dealers, and yes, it is true that buying a car from a dealer can be a thoroughly unsatisfying experience, and then taking it back for service can be even more unsatisfying. In fact, that was one of the great things about Saturn, which in all of this is Saturn seems to me the greatest missed opportunity, because it was started as a different kind of car company, as the slogan said, because it would have better relationship with its customers, a different kind of modus vivendi for the dealers, and it was ignored and neglected, and finally fell of its own weight, but. People don't like the dealers, and that's another thing that has driven the sort of dyspepsia about the car companies in general. Ah, let them fail. You know, I hate my local dealer, Dillinger Chevrolet or whatever. it makes perfect sense.
Dean, thanks very much. We're talking about the future for the U.S. auto manufacturing industry with Dan Neal of the Los Angeles Times and Mickey Maynard of the New York Times. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Steve is with us from Hull, Massachusetts.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have a question, and it is whether Obama's treatment of the car companies contains an implied warning to the banking industry.
Mickey?
I absolutely think it's an implied warning to industry in general and bankers as well. Remember that the banks got their loans from the Bush administration. This is the Obama administration, and I think he's trying to send a completely different signal, maybe an accountability signal here.
And a signal about fairness, too. He did arrange for the dismissal of the head of GM.
That's right. And, there's a lot of resentment in Detroit. I did a piece for The Times last week about Detroiters and their voices, and they're totally perplexed and anguished. And I had even one of my interview subjects cry while we were talking about this. People in Detroit simply don't get why people outside Detroit hate the industry and resent them so much.
Mm-hmm. Steve, thank you.
Yes.
And let's see if we can go now to Karen. And Karen's with us from Culver, Oregon.
Oh, yes. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, all the foreign companies that, like they said, Volkswagen was getting ready to do one, they seem to all be building in the southern states. Why haven't any of them built in Detroit?
Those would be southern right-to-work states, Daniel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
The people in Detroit, they would rather have a job for less money than no job at all, wouldn't they?
You're going to have to take that up with Ron Gettelfinger.
The president of the United Auto Workers.
Right. And Mickey's exactly right. The net number of people in the auto industry really hasn't changed much over the past decade. But that workforce has migrated south to right-to-work states. Yeah. And it's interesting, too.
So the people that are out of work in Detroit, they could get jobs in the south.
One of the things that happens is that these car companies do interviews with – they handpick these people, and they get tens of thousands of applications. They can have whoever they want because there's no union to require them to hire anybody. And the other issue, too, is that these companies have gone where states have given them tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars of incentives, tax breaks, new highway exits. They prepare the land. They roll out the red carpet. And a lot of that probably wouldn't happen up north.
Why not?
Because the states, the states will spend some money on incentives. Absolutely. Indiana does. Ohio does. But some of these states are, not right-to-work states. And the first group of auto plants actually went to states that were not right-to-work states. And as the car companies got some experience working in the United States, they decided to go south where the states were right-to-work states. And that means essentially that you're not forced to join a union if one is organized on your property.
Karen, thanks very much. And finally, Mickey, is the clock now ticking 30 days on Chrysler?
The clock is ticking 30 days on Chrysler and maybe a little slower on General Motors, but they both are facing some real deadlines.
And the president kept saying, with my team, we will be working on this. But is the burden here on those corporate offices in Detroit?
I believe that it is, and it'll be very interesting to see how Fritz Henderson, the new CEO at General Motors, operates now under sort of this iron fist that's about to come down. Mm-hmm. on the company. I really think there was a sense of denial that the Obama administration would make them stick to deadlines, but I don't think anybody's in denial now.
Micheline Maynard, a senior business correspondent for The New York Times, with us from WUOM, our member station in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You can find a link to her profile of Wick Wagner, the former chairman and CEO of GM, at npr.org. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Neil.
And Dan Neil, the automotive critic for the Los Angeles Times. In 2004, he won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism. He joins us today from the Los Angeles Times newsroom. Dan, as always, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Coming up, it was one of the buzzwords of the election, post-racial, but a recently released report measuring up racial inequities puts the term in a new light and on our opinion page. Leonard Pitts joins us next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.